great pleasure to be here to celebrate this great 50th anniversary.
When I think back about what's happened in the 50 years since Everett came up with his theory, I'm blown away by the extent to which the context has changed. And that's going to be the main theme of my talk. There are many things you can worry about in regards to his theory, but since he proposed it, we have started worrying about many of the same things in the context of other problems in physics which have nothing to do with quantum mechanics. But before I tell you what I think, I want to spend about 5 minutes of my time finding out what you think. So imagine you're at a bookmaker in downtown Toronto. You have 50 bucks in your pocket, and you're just trying to guess. So how many of you believe that new physics violating the Schrodinger equation will make large quantum computers impossible? Raise your hand if you think yes. Enough to crack all the internet factorization problems and get very rich. So who thinks yes? Raise your hand. I see 1, 2, 3, 6. Okay. So one, you know, would you bet money? Would you bet your 50 bucks that there's going to be, at the end, that it's going to come out yes or not? Yes, exactly. We're very pragmatic. So we have, don't take your hands down before, we need to do a recount. Raise your hands for yes. 1, 2, 3, 4. And who's for no? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. Please help me in doing an independent count, because we, especially after having lived in the U.S. for a while, I'm afraid that I don't know how to count votes. And who did not raise their hand because they were undecided? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay. Okay. Now it's going to get harder. So now we're betting money. So we have, I counted 4 yes, 11 no, 28 no, 11 undecided. Now, do you believe that all isolated systems obey the Schrodinger equation, or more generally, evolve unitarily? Who's for yes? All. Including the universe, yes. Well, you're welcome to stay undecided if you have any, you know, issues with the question. So who's for yes? And please help me do an independent count here, someone. 1, 2, 3. I mean, let's do it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Don't take your hands down. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. But if you feel that you can't, you don't feel you're in a position to say yes or no, you should definitely vote undecided. So who is for no? Huh? Well, let's come back to that. If you feel that the underlying theory is unitary, but then there's a clock issue, I still think you should count yourself as a unitary person. But that's the way I would was interpreting the question when I wrote it. Who's for no? Okay. This proves that Adrian Kent and the other organizers have done a very, very good job of inviting and represent and fund a diverse cross-section of the community. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. And now comes probably a big vote here. Who's for undecided? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. This is like a Florida election where there isn't that strict control. Okay, now, I counted 16 yes, 10 no, and 20 undecided. If someone else counts. Sure. Huh? Yes. Okay, now it's going to get more lively. Which interpretation of quantum mechanics is closest to your own? Okay? So take the one that's closest, and if you feel none of them is remotely close, you're welcome to pick none. So who feels closest to Copenhagen? Raise your hand. 1, 2. Wow. What about modified dynamics, where the Schrodinger equation is modified to give an explicit collapse? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Crushing the defeat of Copenhagen with explicit collapse. And what about many worlds or consistent histories, a series which have absolutely have no collapse in them? If it's unitary, I would say vote yes. Otherwise, no. This is like Florida. I am not able to check that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and are you holding it halfway up? So Wojtek is in a superposition, 17 and 1 over root 2. 17 plus 1 over root 2. And then we have Bohm. 1, 2. I was expecting more Bohmians here at Perimeter. Tying Copenhagen is pretty respectable. What about modal interpretations? One of the roots, too, for modal. That's it. Anyone else for modal? I was thinking you were going to raise your hand there. No? I put it in specially for you. What about none of the above? Here comes a big vote. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. And is that another one of a root 2? Hang on. And for modal, we had 1 plus 1 over root 2 again. So what I got was, for the first question, now you can do the summation and see how many people double voted and get a free ticket to Florida. 16, 10, and 20. And 20. This is yes, no, undecided. Yes. No, undecided. For the 3, I counted 2, 5, 17, plus 1 over root 2 for Wojtek, and 1 plus 1 over root 2 here for modal, and 22 plus 1 over root 2 here for... Yeah, we left out... we left out Bohm, which was 2. Now, finally, it's one thing to say you believe in unitarity or a member of the Unitary Church or whatever, but what about this one? Do you feel comfortable saying that Everettian parallel worlds are as real as our universe? Who would say yes? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. And you were moving your hands like that. Was that the superposition? Huh? Huh? Okay, so so can we... 13? Okay. Who is for no? Who is for no? Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. And who is undecided on this one? Another big vote. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. And anyone is welcome to blow 5 minutes of their own talk time to pose different questions, of course. But I think maybe the main thing I take away from this, I guess I should add my own votes also. But they will become clear. Huh?
Did you feel comfortable?
Yeah, that's an explicitly subjectivist question. There's no onto anything.
Yeah, well, we're interested in the subject.
So, the. I think the main thing I take away from this is that we should give a round of applause to the organizers for inviting people to talk. Okay, so what do I think?
Well, there are a lot of people who have worried a lot about what Everett's theory implies since he proposed it. And there are many things that, you know, you can worry about in life. And I will not even attempt to go through all the interesting worries that have been raised by previous speakers here. I'm just going to try to get through talking about some of the ones that I felt people were worrying about most passionately here at the meeting. In brief, the Occam razor worry that parallel universes feel wasteful and frivolous, the two different worries about probabilities, getting probabilities from a deterministic theory. First, how you get equal probabilities and issues to do with that. And then, once you got equal probabilities, the harder problem, how you do unequal probabilities. And then the invisibility worry, if all these worlds are here, why can't we see them? And the basis worry, what is it that selects out the preferred basis? And the word worry, which had some very interesting discussions about yesterday with Jim Hartle and Wojtek Zurek, about what we really should mean with words like this and whether we really know what we mean. And the weirdness worry, that this is just too strange and crazy. So let's start with the first one. And for all of these worries, the key question I want to address again is not whether you should be worried or not, which is ultimately up to you, but whether these worries are unique to quantum mechanics or whether they also have appeared in other contexts in physics since then and are, in a sense, deeper worries which are not specific to quantum physics that we could not blame Everett for. All right? So let's start with the parallel universe worries. It's interesting that there's been a lot of books and articles, TV programs and things recently about parallel universes, and almost none of them have anything to do with U. Everett's parallel universes. Right? Almost none of them here. This one talks a little bit about Everett's parallel universes, but the other ones are all about other kinds of parallel universes. So, yes?
Good. Excellent. I'm glad people are worrying about Everett.
Okay.
Yes. I think it's fair to say that there are also a lot of other people who have worried a lot about other kinds. And they worry a lot, you know. Paul Feinhardt gets so worried that he says, this isn't science. Mm-hmm. Whereas Alex Vilenkin feels that it's somehow it's inevitable to have these inflation-based parallel universes. And David Rose, Jim's esteemed Carr colleague, likes to say, I hate it. Mm-hmm. Even though his very own graduate student, Frank Wilczek, is a lot more open-minded about it. And people in astrophysics have vested interest in inflation, they often get kind of positive about these things. So people worry and argue a lot, and nonetheless, the ones that they worried a lot about things which have nothing to do with Everett. Right? So I think it's fair to say that parallel universes are not anymore an issue specifically linked to quantum impacts. And here are the four kinds of parallel universes that I've mainly seen people worry about in the literature. The most pedestrian kind is the one you get if you simply have space 1.0, the kind Euclid imagined, which is infinite, in a universe of finite age, where we can only see a finite volume. There will then be infinitely many other volumes of the same size, and already that's pretty crazy, because we know the probability of getting life in one volume like this isn't zero. It happened here, so it's going to happen again and again, infinitely many other times, and there will be the Schmidt-Rieder Institute somewhere far, far away with another conference. out there, and people worry about that. Even though it's the existence of infinite space is both so far consistent with data, and more importantly, it's a prediction, a generic prediction of inflation theory, which is the most popular paradigm we have in cosmology right now. What made the kind of space you have? Moreover, inflation also predicts, has this irritating problem that it never ends. And then predicts.
So you get these other regions far, far away, which are separated from us causally in the sense by space between us and them still inflating. So we can never get there, even if we're infinitely patient. And if the fundamental laws of physics, string theory, loop quantum gravity, whatever they are, have more than one solution, cosmological inflation has this property that it transforms this potentiality into reality. It will actually make infinite regions of space, realizing each of those solutions, effectively giving even different low-energy laws of physics in different parts of space. And this kind of parallel universe goes back quite a ways. Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake the year 1600 for speculating about infinite space with infinite worlds in it. People more recently haven't gotten into quite as much trouble, but there's been a lot of debate about this kind recently. Then we have Everett's parallel universes, which don't, whereas these here are simply other regions far, far away in space-time. These are elsewhere in Hilbert space, right here in space. And finally, a very small minority, including myself, like to, and actually two other people in this room, to my astonishment, are interested in the idea that there might be even more diverse parallel universes corresponding to different mathematical structures altogether, residing elsewhere in the Platonic landscape of mathematical objects. So whether you believe any of these or not, people have worried about a variety of types of parallel universes. And what's interesting is that there's quite good evidence for both of these, as I've mentioned, particularly coming in from cosmology, where the theory of inflation has predicted very successfully measurements of numbers with decimal places on them, like the curvature of space, the spectral index from inflation, and things like that, and solved a host of problems, made most people buy into this, even though it predicts these parallel universes. Since these are arguments which most of you have heard before, let me also, just for fun, tell you about one other Everett independent argument for parallel universes, which may be new to you. Fotini.
Just from where you were before, some of the parallel universes that arise there, these figures can make probabilistic arguments on something that's infinite. And then it makes a difference whether you're really, really big or infinite.
That's
so
correct.
Would you say that the observations tell us that we're infinite or really, really big?
That's a very good question. We clearly have no, we clearly cannot say based on observation that space is infinite. I'm just looking at a finite volume. However, what we're ultimately testing is not just the notion that space is infinite. We're testing specific mathematical theories. So the theory of inflation makes a number of predictions. And it predicts that space should be flat and a variety of other things that we've checked. And it also predicts that space is infinite. Not just really, really big, but really infinite. So the best reason to believe that space is infinite is not because you've gone out and checked, but because inflation is the best, because we have good reason to believe in inflation, and it predicts that. That would be the logic. I'm not saying you need to buy this, of course, I'm just making the key point that those arguments have nothing to do with Everett at all. So let me try a very different sort of argument, which you may not have heard, for parallel universes. Who here feels it would be nice to discover a theory of everything, a complete description of reality, which is really intuitive? Raise your hand. Okay, so since I have the hockey stick here and defend myself, I'm going to play the devil's advocate and say, forget it. And the reason I think we should forget it is because Charles Darwin teaches us that we only have intuition for things which were useful that our ancestors have intuition about, namely simple classical physics, the parabolic trajectory of a flying rock, and things like that. And that makes the firm prediction that whenever we use technology to observe things which our ancestors have no use of, our intuition should break down. And contrary-wise, we'll come back to this later, because this is a fun question. Contrary-wise, I am personally arguing, my personal guess is that it's all just equations. We live in a mathematical universe, and it's a mathematical object of some sort described by some equations. Maybe it's a 3+1-dimensional Lie-manifold, maybe it's a Hilbert space. Most likely it's some mathematical structure we haven't yet discovered. But in any case, that the equations are it in terms of the complete description. And they may or may not be particularly intuitive, and based on Darwin, I would expect we would not find them intuitive at all. And if you have trouble sleeping, I can highly recommend the following sleeping pill. It's a very long paper I wrote recently where I argued that this hypothesis that our universe is completely mathematical actually follows from some pretty innocent-sounding assumptions, that there is an external reality which is independent of us. This paper is titled The Mathematical Universe, and I will not dwell on it any further here. However, if it's true that our universe is mathematical, well, then there are many mathematical objects, the integers, the real numbers, the dodecahedron, and so on. And the key challenge as a physicist, if you're just given a bunch of equations,
is to figure out what on earth such a world would feel like to live in and see if it's consistent with this. And this is obviously a very, very difficult problem. So putting it differently, you start with just the equations, just the abstract mathematical description of reality, and have to derive from that what it feels like. That we feel like we live in a 3-dimensional space where things happen kind of at random and time slows down when you go fast and so on. A highly non-trivial thing. I don't think anybody knows how to make such a calculation. Although, if it is true that our universe is completely mathematical, in principle, this should follow from that. And as an analogy, suppose someone gives you a complete description of a car, but not the kind that's useful to you, just the complete description by saying, here's where all the atoms are, basically. No? That's not, if you've never seen a car before because you're an alien and you just landed here in your hovercraft, that's not going to do you a whole lot of good, right? What you would really like is a user manual written in your own favorite Martian language that you can read to say, this is how to operate the darn thing. You know, you turn the steering wheel, this happens. Nonetheless, if you, the alien, are sufficiently smart, by just examining where all the atoms are and examining the car in great detail, you should eventually be able to figure out how it works and write your own user manual in your own language. And this is how I think of our challenge as physicists. We're faced with this mathematical structure we live in, these equations, and we have to figure out the user manual and write down the postulates of quantum mechanics or relativity or whatever it is that tell us how we actually relate what we see to what the math is, how we actually operate this universe, how we actually can build gadgets to do what we want. So I'm not saying that this kind of user manual, in other words, theories written in English, are useless. They are very useful. I'm just saying that they're not fundamental in my picture, in the sense that in principle, They should be derivable from just the math. Okay, so suppose you buy that. Then, here's an argument for why there should be parallel universes, which has nothing to do with Everett, which you might not have heard before. We look around us in the universe, and we notice it seems really, really complicated. To describe the entire state of our Hubble volume, the part of space that we can see, requires an enormous amount of bits if you're going to specify the position of every star, every grain of sand, and so on. Perhaps it's a Google bits, something in that ballpark. Okay? Now, if you're looking for a theory of everything, which is going to be a complete description of reality that you can publish, you're probably hoping that it's going to take less than a Google bits. Otherwise, it won't meet the 4-page limit for FISREP letters. Right? You want to find something much, much, which can be described in much fewer bits somehow with some equations and words or whatever. However, as we know from algorithmic complexity theory, if you have Google random seeming bits and there's no hit, either there's some kind of fractal and you can just compress it all to almost nothing, or if you take inflation seriously, these bits here mostly look like just realizations of a Gaussian random field, which means effectively they're somewhat more or less incompressible random numbers. There's no way we can describe all these bits by much fewer bits. So if you are looking for a simple theory of everything, we must live in the multiverse. Because the only way you can describe something like this with much fewer bits is if what your theory is describing is actually an ensemble. Let's take a step back and see what this means here. For example, if we look at the first level of parallel universes here, an infinite space, inflation, these are the pictures from the doubling map satellite taken from here. Far, far away, a doubling map, another satellite would take it picture which looks kind of similar qualitatively, but the cold and hot spots would be in different places. Right? That's because inflation generated these random phases differently in each part of space. But every possible W map, every possible map like that is realized somewhere. So all the information in here, and in fact all the information in our classical initial conditions, are really just telling us where we are in space. It's like all those bits are our multiversal telephone number, where we are. So if you have a theory which simply predicts an infinite space with all the initial conditions realized somewhere, the theory itself can be very simple. It might only require about 1,000 bits or so. You just have to say what the gauge group is of a standard model and what theory of gravity you have. You have to specify 32 dimensionless numbers, 26 for the standard model, 6 more for cosmology, which have been measured with lots of decimal places.
Don't you expect there'll be a high probability?
The R doesn't make any sense.
That's also true. There will be ones which are completely indistinguishable if you have an infinite space, and holographic principle says we have a finite number. In that case, there are equivalence classes. We have to say which one of them you're in.
But the classes aren't located in particular.
Right. But the fact remains, if you specify the theory, you specify the whole ensemble. And then the information about initial conditions isn't telling you something about the fundamental space-time. It's just telling you something about the kind of region we're in. Right? And moreover, if the level 2 multiverse, as I like to call it, but the
one which has been so talked about in the context of inflation in the string landscape is true, then even those 32 dimensionless numbers, many of them may also vary from place to place. And maybe the gauge group of the standard model also varies from place to place because you have different string compactifications or whatnot. So maybe you only need 100 bits or so to specify the string theory or the loop quantum gravity. And then even most of those bits also just told you about where you are in that larger ensemble. What about Everett? Well, the real kicker is there's no more anything new by the time we get to this, because all of the Everett parallel worlds already happened somewhere else in space, if space is infinite. So you don't economize anything further here. Finally, if this level 4 multiverse of all mathematical structures is correct, then in fact the theory everything has zero bits, because these 100 bits are just telling us which mathematical structure we're in, which the equations are. So in summary, the bigger the multiverse, the simpler the theory is from a mathematical point of view, which is exactly the opposite of the Occam worry, right? Where you would feel that parallel universes are complicated and wasteful. But regardless how you feel of that, the main point I want you to take away from this is that the Occam worry is not unique to quantum mechanics. So I put the big no here, because it happens also for all these other kinds of parallel universes. Good. Let's switch now to the next worry about probabilities, which we've had a number of very, very interesting talks about here at this meeting.
I'll leave it to you. But if what you view as simple is how simple the mathematical equations are, then I'm arguing that a multiverse theory is simpler. If you view it as simple, and your theory which has a minimum amount of space in it or something like that, right, then you would prefer that what we can observe is it. And it would be even simpler if there's nothing outside of this room either. I'm not taking sides on this. The point I want to make is just, again, that this worry is not unique to quantum mechanics, just a big theme of my talk. And let's come back to Olaf's question, which I suspect is about this afterwards, because I just want to. I've spent more than a seventh of my time on the first bullet here. And what that, even though he doesn't have a hockey stick, he said he has a pretty high power laser. What about the probability worry? So we heard a number of very interesting talks yesterday about this, and this morning. Let's start with a mixture of equal probabilities. If you have a superposition like 1 over root 2 something plus 1 over root 2 something that appears in causal theory. Well, there are some mathematical structures, or some, even if you don't find this mathematical structure stuff, some theories have multiple observers, some don't, right? And some theories have multiple observers who can't interact, in fact. If you have an infinite space, you can imagine an observer living very far away from another observer, so they're just causally disconnected for all practical purposes. There are theories that have them, and there are ones that don't. No big deal about that. Moreover, there are some theories which allow you to clone observers, and some that don't. This particular example, I find very scary. But maybe a more down-to-earth example is if you imagine the Waterloo computer science department designing a really intelligent robot sometime soon, which is as smart as a human being, it would be trivial to clone that robot, just power it down, copy all of its information to another one, and you power them both up. And to make it a bit more interesting, let's imagine that what we do is we take the observer, put the observer to sleep, put the observer into a clone, the cloner, and then put the two clones, one clone in room 0, one clone in room 1, and then they wake up. Nothing quantum about this, but clearly, you could argue, if you want, that it might make sense for the observer here to say that when he wakes up, he's going to find himself in room 0 or room 1, apparently at random. And if you repeat this experiment many, many, many times, so you get n
times, you get 2 to the n clones of this observer, which again is a little bit scary, then a generic one of these observers will look at his list of which rooms he's woken up in, and it's going to look like a kind of random string of zeros and ones with an order half zeros, an order half ones. And if this is a very, very long string and the observer does a bunch of randomness tests on this, most of the observers are going to find that it's going to pass the randomness tests. There are worries. There's always going to be one observer which measures all zeros and gets severely confused. There's going to be another, you could argue that this particular observer is severely confused anyway, so who cares about that? But the key point I want to emphasize here is that this has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. This is something which already Boltzmann worried about, and maybe he worried about it a little too much since he killed himself. But the equal probability case, I would argue, is very interesting, and there are things one can be worried about, but let's not blame U. Everett for them. And that applies both to the whole issue of whether one deserves, whether it's fair to call this probability, what one should mean by probability, and also issues, evidential issues, interesting issues that, for instance, David Allbert has emphasized. What about the unequal probability case? So I put a big no, emphatic no here. This is, again, not something unique to quantum. What about the unequal probability case? Why do we square the amplitudes in the Born rule? Here, I think we've reached the first of the worries where we really need to put a yes. This is really special to quantum mechanics, directly linked to the whole Hilbert space structure of quantum mechanics. And I'm not going to go into any of the details here. We've heard a number of nice talks yesterday by Wojtek and David Wallace and others about how we can do this procedure with an ancillary system and so on and so forth. And if you worry about that, at least you can really say that you're worrying about something truly quantum. What about the invisibility worry and the basis worry here? These are, in my opinion, worries which were really, really justified in 1957 when Everett put out his theory. And in my opinion, it's a brilliant piece of work, but it really had these two gaping holes. It did not give a good explanation for this. And the reason was that decoherence hadn't yet been discovered. Right? That happened in 1970, Hans-Dieter Tse, and 13 years later. It was a really significant thing which happened afterwards. I don't think we should blame you, Everett, for not inventing decoherence. He invented one really great thing, but there was more to do. And let me just say a few words about. So I'm also crossing these out because I got the sense so far during the meeting that these are the only worries on my list which nobody in this room is actually really worried about anymore, which people generally regard as a solved problem. And if you disagree, I'd be very interested to hear. Let me then say a little bit about decoherence. Very little, because Wojtek and others have already covered it so nicely. If you, for example, balance a playing card which has a perfectly sharp bottom edge exactly on its base like this, and there are no air molecules or anything bumping into it, it would just classically, of course, stand up forever, and quantum mechanically it would fall down in about 25 seconds into a superposition of left and right. You've probably done that problem in grad school. And that means a density matrix would not only have these two big blobs on the diagonal, but these two off-diagonal blobs. And as you all know, decoherence, little photons or air molecules bouncing off of this in this case, will very rapidly suppress the off-diagonal elements. And I want to mention just a few numbers here, since we've talked a lot about qualitative issues. Just remind you that this is actually very quantitative as well. Wojtek mentioned yesterday that there have been a number of beautiful experiments recently by Arosh and many others, really checking that this actually works, which is better because it's just a straight prediction from the Schrodinger equation. Right? So if you have a density matrix, rho of x and x prime, then as you saw in that little diagram, of course, the off-diagonal elements get suppressed. And if you look at the particular case where something collides with your object, there's a very simple result. You get the good approximation, where you just multiply the whole density matrix by another function and some phase factor, which suppresses the off-diagonal elements. A single scattering or multiple scatterings will suppress things like that. So the farther off you are from the diagonal, the faster you're suppressed, and the longer you wait, the more you're suppressed. And then tidal forces, as opposed to scattering, also give a very, very similar effect. I had lots of fun working this out in the first paper I ever wrote up, actually, I never showed it to my advisor until after he had signed my dissertation, because I thought he would disapprove of me thinking about such stuff. And The bottom line is that these formulas are very easy to remember. Essentially, a single scattering, if this is in a superposition of being in two places, a single scattering of a particle finds out where my thing is to order the de Broglie wavelength of the particle that did the scattering. So basically, that single scattering suppresses off-diagonal elements down to about the de Broglie wavelength. And that's the bottom line of how to think about these formulae. If you plug in some numbers and ask, for example, what the de Broglie wavelength is of different physical nuisances you might have causing decoherence and what the typical flux of them is, and then you see that for something like an electron, many of these are completely irrelevant. On the other hand, except air is not. And just as I was about in the process of submitting this, I realized that this paper, which I had been unable to find in JPhys, was actually in ZPhys. And that Z wasn't a typo. It was Zeitschrift der Physik. And I found this beautiful paper by Jorsten Say. So it's nice to be scooped, at least by such great people. And they had done exactly this stuff, and also had a nice table. At least I was pleased to see that the numbers agreed well, and at least my advisor didn't get upset because he didn't even know about it. So that was good. What's interesting, and the sort of the bottom line, I think, for how important decoherence is for various objects is the equilibrium coherence length that things acquire if you wait for a while. The wave function will, of course, always tend to spread out, right, if you leave things alone, whereas the coherence constantly keeps localizing it more. And if you just leave, for example, a bowling ball alone on the table for a while, its center mass is actually only coherently superposed over these ridiculously small distances here, whereas for example, an electron in a lab vacuum, you don't have to worry too much about decoherence as long as there isn't powerful light shining on it and things like that. And finally, which is perhaps the most important conclusion for foundational work, is that if you want to test something like the Girardi-Rimini-Weber explicit collapse theory, which a number of you voted for here, then you have to work very hard to make sure you reduce all these other sources of decoherence below that low level that predicts, because the two of the effects look the same. Right? So it's very, very hard to see otherwise. And finally, one fun application of these formulae that I inflicted on you here, it applies to our brain. So Roger Penrose didn't return the calls from this journalist. And that was a bad thing to do, because then the journalist decided to start the article by saying that Sir Roger Penrose is incoherent and Max Tegmark says he can prove it. So always return calls. I wasn't actually out of Penrose at all. I was just intrigued by his suggestion that we have a quantum computer on our heads. And here's the calculation I did. He said, if our neurons have anything to do with the information processing of our consciousness, which, of course, is what most of our biophysics colleagues believe, then if I'm doing a quantum computation, that means that some neuron will at some point be in a superposition of firing and not firing. And when you cut to the chase, what that really means is that of order a million or so sodium ions are in a spatial superposition of being outside and inside the axon membrane. And it's very easy to just use these formulae to work out what the decoherence time is, both from water molecules bumping into this and other ions and so on. And when you do the numbers, you get very, very short numbers, 10 to the minus 20 seconds or so. And maybe Roger Penrose thinks that fast, but I certainly don't. which suggests that our brain is a very, very classical sort of computer. And even some microtubule suggestion that I calculated gives extremely short time scales. This comes as no surprise to those of you who work on quantum computation, of course, because you don't put your computer in a 300 Kelvin fluid, right? But nonetheless, I think it's interesting qualitatively, because if you try to put consciousness into the picture, if you think of the whole universe, instead of separated into two pieces, just an environment, an object and its environment, into three. So we have the subject, which is just the computer I have here, my conscious perceptions, the object I'm looking at, and the environment. Then there are three different interaction Hamiltonians here, which all do interesting things, right? Measurement is when I interact with the object, perhaps as Wojtek said yesterday, via the environment in practice. We'll come back to that. When I'm not looking at the object, it might still be interacting with the environment and decohering. And finally, my brain can decohere directly also, even if I'm not looking at the object at all. And these three processes have very familiar behaviors if you look at the density matrix. So let's take a simple example of a two-state object, spin one-half system. And those two states correspond to where I am in each of these little two-by-two blocks here in this density matrix. And then I have three states of my brain. Either I'm confused because I haven't measured yet, say, or I'm happy because I measured spin up, or I'm unhappy because I measured spin down. Now, if we start the object out, I start out confused, object spin up. This is a density matrix. Now I just let the object evolve unitarily. I can get something like this, for instance, where the object is in the superposition of these two states. But the entropy was constant here. Now, if the object interacts with the environment, I can suppress the off-diagonal elements. So the entropy of this density matrix goes up. All very familiar. That's what happens in open systems often. Now, when I make the observation, I get entangled with the object. So if it's all unitary and Everettian, then the density matrix now becomes like this, because we're in a superposition of me seeing spin up and the particle being spin up and vice versa. And then, of course, if I manage to get it, and then this is, of course, just a sum of these two states, which will very rapidly which decohere in absolutely no time at all. If they haven't already decohered through the environment, right, they would decohere because of what my neurons are doing. And here we see that for both of these observers, the entropy decreased when they looked. And so there's a natural symmetry here. Entropy increases when we don't look, and it decreases when we look, because we are getting entangled with the system. And of course, one has to have things like this to understand why one can have states of sometimes quite low entropy. So, well, Wojtek is making a very completely valid point that I completely agree with, that when you go from here to here, there is always environment involved. There's never a case where the Stern-Gerlach information goes straight into my neuron. So in practice,
I think I'm talking about another point.
Okay.
By adding to the entropy and the algorithmic information content.
Yeah.
Can
you repeat that, please?
By adding to the entropy and the algorithmic information content of the records. Well, wait, I can explain this better than that.
I can explain. That's the point I explained yesterday.
Okay.
Right.
But I'd love to hear more about it. So why don't I just wrap up the talk and then we'll come back to it. So to summarize, I think decoherence is an extremely important discovery, which we shouldn't underestimate the importance of when we talk about quantum physics, because if it weren't for that, we would have these really, really embarrassing problems, which would haunt us. But nobody said that they were still worried about it, so I have to cross them out. Are you worried about decoherence? About no problems?
I'm not worried, but I know a lot of people who are, because they want a theory an interpretation that's universal and that applies not just to small subsystems, which are the only ones where you can apply decoherence. There has to be an environment.
Small. Not small. Anything less than half the universe.
Right, that's a
minority.
So let me just wrap up the talk, because I'm almost done, and then we'll come right back to this, okay? Finally, the word worry. What do we mean by exist?
real, and things like that. Well, I completely agree with the point which Jim Horton made in a very nice article, basically that human language is not exactly equipped and evolved to describe quantum mechanics well. Be very careful when you use these kinds of words. And you're free to use the word real or the word is as it may, in whatever fashion you want. I want to just comment on why I voted yes when I said I still feel the way I'd like to use the word real, that the many worlds of Everett are real. And here is the reason for that. I think of this to me, what's real is a mathematical structure that we live, that is our universe. And that means, so if I have a universe, for example, which contains many observers, many parts of space, in an infinite space that I can't see, they're still all there in the mathematical space. So I'm going to say that they're real, regardless of whether I can see them or not, rather than saying that Saturn is real because it's in our Hubble volume, but it's another planet that's outside of our event horizon, of our horizon, is not real. I would prefer, I find it more clear to simply say that we live in this large space-time, some of which we cannot observe. And I think of the case in quantum mechanics exactly analogously. We live in this Hilbert space, and tough luck, you know, we can only observe a tiny fraction of it. But mathematically, I would say it's all there. And moreover, there is this very striking symmetry. If I have a Sturm-Gerlach apparatus, and I measure the particle that was prepared to spin in the x-direction, then there's going to be one branch where max measure spin up, another branch where max measure spin down. They're there in the Hilbert space, they're there in the wave function. It's a completely symmetric situation. Even what's up and down, you know, you can argue has no a priori meaning. So it would seem very artificial to me to say that one of them is real and one of them is not. Of course, if we choose to use the word real to be only what we can see, then by definition, only one of them is real. I'm just, again, trying to find why I like to use the word real differently. To me, if it's the math that's real, we humans came along later, the universe would do just fine without us, and we can only observe part of it. So to me, it's more natural to say, there is this big Hilbert space, you know, we right here can observe still a part of it, and but by symmetry, you know, the other maxes in there are going to feel that they are real in any sense, I feel them real. But again, this isn't critique or anything, it's just my justification for why I feel it's not that confusing to call them real. Let's close with what I perceive actually as being the thing that people worry most about. Let's face it, parallel universes are weird. They're just too crazy. In fact, I even read on some blog recently that someone said they're just too crazy. And there's this guy, Pegmark, who believes in it, but you should discount that because he believes in even more crazy stuff. Typical of a conflict.
Here, to my defense, I'm going to bring back Mr. Darwin. I really think we are not taking him seriously enough. We're pretending that we're here, these clever, disinterested seekers of truth, you know, forgetting that we're actually evolved to eat bananas. You know?
And if you take seriously, if you would, at that time,
when he wrote The Origin of Species, have predicted what would happen with physics theories and whether they would seem weird, you would have predicted that every time we develop new technology to see beyond the human scale, it should seem weird, because there was no reason, it had no survival value to evolve intuition for that. And now let's look at what happened after Darwin. We started measuring what happens when things move near the speed of light. Whoops, time slows down. I think that's pretty darn weird. Then we start looking at what happens with microscopic things. Little particles seem to be in two places at once, and all the other quantum stuff seems pretty weird to me. Parallel universes seem pretty weird. Then we look at general relativity. Black holes, to me, are extremely weird. In fact, Carl Schwarzschild thought they were so weird that he hoped on his deathbed that they didn't actually exist. when he was lying in the field hospital in World War I after having derived this stuff. But tough luck, they're out there. And now we even have so many of them that astronomers have stopped giving names to them. They just give them the boring numbers. And I think if anything, the theory of quantum gravity, which we're looking for, is going to seem even more weird. And if we restrict our search to just things which are intuitive, I think we're not going to find the correct theory. We might even miss it, even if someone has written down the equations. So again, basically because if one of our ancestors was sitting outside of her cave, you know, thinking really hard about quantum physics, she wouldn't have noticed that tiger that was sneaking up from behind and it'd been cleaned right out of the gene pool. So I think we should expect the theory, the true theory, to feel weird. And the fact that quantum mechanics feel, if quantum mechanics didn't seem weird, I would frankly be very suspicious of it. So let me close with Richard Feynman, one of my great heroes. People also like to worry about the anthropic principle. The most extreme form of the anthropic principle is what you might call the Epicurean version, that the universe must be such that we like it. And nice and intuitive and all that. So here is a little video, which you may not have seen, of Richard Feynman himself commenting on this very question. I'd like to share this with you. Let me take off my mic and put it here so you can hear him.
Kind of saying that you don't understand it, meaning I don't believe it, it's too crazy, it's the kind of thing I'm not going to accept it. The other part, well, this kind, I hope you'll come along with me. I don't have to accept it. Because it's the way nature works. If you want to know the way nature works, we looked at it carefully, look at it, that's the way it looks. You don't like it? Go somewhere else. To another universe, where the universe is simpler. Philosophically more pleasing, more psychologically easy.
Thank you.
I want to say, I don't think there's a representative here of this persuasion, but there's one worry that's not on your list. And I think you might figure it out on the physics community a little bit. I mean, what is the function of configuration space? Yeah, if you forget about decoherence before, what is the way function of configuration space? I said something about this in my talk, which was in a way a response to this worry. But I think it's a worry that C++ will have anyway. And the point behind it, that seems just too weird to you. It's an interesting issue here about what's weird to philosophers.
Well, to me, if there's this mathematical structure that has some space in it, you know, it's not our business to ask why it's. What's the meaning? What's the purpose of configuration space?
It's the thought that it's what makes a configuration space a configuration space. You've got some set of particles that have configuration.
Yeah.
So if all you've got is wave function, that's it, the wave function moment, then what is the meaning of the function on the configuration? What is the meaning of the configuration?
Are you wondering why do we feel that there is a space-time in the first place?
No,
if you go into quantum field theory, then of course you have this infinite dimension of the Earth space, and if you look in this Fock space of two particles, you know, just from the way you've derived it, they live in six dimensions. You have three particles that live in nine dimensions.
You're not champion this far. It's one I think you take seriously in the entire case.
Yeah. There are people, Tim Wood and Shelley Goldstein, who have a worry like this. I don't know how to say it succinctly in a way that does them justice. There's a feeling that if you have a theory, and this amounts to a worry about the world, it amounts to a worry about certain ways of construing GRW, it amounts to a worry about certain ways of construing Bohm's theory, that that if you really mean to say the fundamental metaphysics of your theory doesn't have a three-dimensional space in it at a fundamental level, the three-dimensional space is somehow emergent. Okay. There's a feeling, this isn't a feeling I share either, but Simon says, because I'm interested in what these people have to say and I talk to them a lot, I take it seriously. There's a worry that a structure like that is not simply weird, it's in a certain sense incoherent. That maybe the most sympathetic way to put it is, what science is for is to explain how objects move around in three-dimensional space. It couldn't be that a satisfactory explanation starts off by denying that there is such a thing.
So to me, yeah, the configuration space is a very serious worry I have about the Bohm interpretation in particular, which sounds all great. We have one particle and the probability current lives in three sections. But if we have two particles, right, then if I have two particles in the Bohm interpretation, my probability current lives in six dimensions. If I have 10 particles and I have to go to 3 to 10, I mean, it suddenly lost much of its elegance to me, and let alone when you try to do field theory with it relativistically. I think that the second question
no,
may not be...
You're in the same position with Everett. You have at least prima facie, your fundamental ontology is you've got this object that floats around in configuration space.
Well, I prefer to think of it in terms of field theory, and there I think the big mystery is why is it that the Hamiltonian of quantum field theory is of this very, very special form that it's just you have a little operator sitting at each place in space and you just sum them up, right? This is not at all generic at all. Then you have to have an operator which is of this very special form. Or saying differently, why is Lagrangian local in real space? Right? That's a very, very deep question. And I think ultimately many of these things should probably trace back to that. And I'm not claiming to have a good answer to it. Yeah.
I guess this is kind of a meta question. There was a talk yesterday, I think it was yours.
Mine.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Where you're talking about confirmation theory, right? And you said, well, one possible theory you can have of the world is everything happens. Okay, and that can't be disproved because, well, it doesn't actually, any data that you see is consistent with that.
Right.
Okay. And so this sounds a lot to me like Max's thing about all possible universes exist. Right, that sounds a lot like everything happens. Now, maybe a different question we should ask is, I read somewhere, somebody can probably give me the reference. Perhaps a better way of describing science is to say what cannot happen. Okay, because there's the inductivist chicken problem. You say this is going to happen and you see it, well, that might mean that doesn't actually, that's not science because it's induction and induction is unreliable. Instead, you want to make a scientific theory, you have to say what does not happen. Okay, and I'm not seeing anything from this model which says such and so cannot happen because the way the model is put together is that everything does happen somewhere.
That's an interesting question. Let me make one comment. I think. It's very important to remember that we're talking about things happening always in the context of some mathematical theory. And it's actually very difficult to write down mathematical theories even that are internally self-consistent, right? That's why mathematicians get paid, to prove that some thing that they discovered actually is consistent and hangs together. And if just anything you wrote down made sense, the math department here in Waterloo would be closed. And to take a more physics-related example of that, look at string theory. It gets lots of flack for predicting this landscape with 10 to 500, or in fact, even infinitely many solutions. Well, so far, the problem is not that we have too many sets of mathematical truths, many mathematical truths in this world. We still have zero. There are no string theory models which predict this standard model with broken supersymmetry and succeed in giving cosmological inflation. For example, I just finished this long project with Mark Kirkberg and Chinese Kashu and others where we looked at string theory models and tried to see if we could find anyone that fit the cosmology data that inflamed it. And we actually looked at infinitely many. None of them worked. So I don't want to dismiss this and say, you know, it's not a serious issue that you raise, but I think it's important to remember it's not that easy to write down a mathematical theory, even one, that it fits what we see. So we haven't done it yet. Question?
Can we go back to the argument that the parallel universe is based on the number of bits in the
description?
The number of bits in the equations.
Okay.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, and you said something here that I thought we need to go back to. You said, now, the 10 to 100 bits, you said, you depicted that as kind of incompressible, right? But then you said, unless it's some kind of fractal.
Yeah,
it's
another
thing. A lot of people argue that very likely the universe is some kind of fractal-like thing that could be reduced to a
Yeah, so there are people like Stephen Wolfram who seem to believe that we live in a fractal, that if you just run the right computer program or something, it's going to output exactly this. I think that, my guess is that that's wrong. Here's why. For example, if you just run a Stern-Gerlach apparatus a billion times, right, you're going to get what looks like a billion random zeros and ones. So a fractalist has to maintain that there's actually a hidden algorithm behind that. It's not really random. It's just a pseudo-random string of numbers.
Right.
I don't believe that. And inflation, which is what generated all these initial conditions in our standard model of cosmology, did it exactly with the same quantum mechanism as the Stern-Gerlach apparatus. Right? The reason we have Gaussian fluctuations is because the ground state, the harmonic oscillator, is Gaussian. That's where it comes from. So my guess is that it's not fractal-like. But Wolfram would certainly disagree. You were first.
Yeah. There was sort of a sociological side to your talk, so let me use that as an excuse to ask a sociological question. And go back to your list of worries slide, the one where you check it off and you have no's and yeses and the other ones. One of them made the category of yes. This is a real worry. There's the unequal probabilities and how we account for the Born rule. And I think that many of us feel that the philosophical sort of slants at that problem haven't gotten very far. Your last.
Well, I was surprised actually at this meeting, but yet coming with a feeling it may have been mistaken that people were actually more worried about this one than about this one.
I think that people like to worry and talk about what they can answer easily. But I wonder if you think that to some degree people feel like they've used up their weirdness quota by indicating many worlds, and they're not willing to say, you know, despite us asking you to believe in many worlds, we actually have a problem with the unequal probabilities, and there may actually be some more physics required to solve that.
Yeah, so since this is a sociological question, let's do something sociological. Who is actually worried about the unequal probability? And in other words, suppose you buy this, that there's no problem with getting equal probabilities. Who would still be worried about that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a matter in your hand. And what about, who's worried about this? The first one, equal probability. There we see actually quite a lot more hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think Simon would say the same thing, is that once you understand the equal probabilities part, then we feel at least you can take the step and get the unequal really easily. Equal was hard. Unequal is just an algebra.
The unequal case is it's really a theorem once you've got the equal case.
Yeah.
It's a theorem. I mean, it's a theorem predicated on three postulates of decision theory. You need to look at those two postulates and ask yourself how any rational agent could question.
Well, I've read, Wallace's paper and Wojciech's paper.
What year?
Approximately 2000. Mine wasn't evolving that much.
2005 was three postulates. They are innocuous. And it's a theorem.
I don't agree that they're innocuous. If one starts with simple, what we mostly initially believe intuitively and then have to give up about catechetic probabilities, which is counting outcomes, the probabilities are so weird that they don't obey simple innocuous sounding things.
It's a theorem. You need to question the premises.
That's what I'm questioning. I'm questioning whether one has stable probabilities at all.
What do you think? You're in charge here?
Yeah? But you are doing so well. Who was next?
I'm glad you brought up decoherence. I just had a question about the work decoherence is doing here, and it's based on some not completely thought through idea, but it's parallel to the notion of reversibility objection, which is that if you have a world in which classicality is maintained by decoherence in some time direction, you can also, the time reverse of that world is a world in which classicality returned by weak coherence, by coherence with the environment. So there's something extra that's going on in. I shouldn't say there's something extra. You could argue that this is a demonstration A, that decoherence is not necessary to maintain classicality, but it is sufficient. I'm really wondering, I think in general, what this makes me think about is whether there's something in classicality built into very special presuppositions about what our initial states are, about how our ability in particular to divide the world up into system, environment, and apparatus. And I think actually that this is probably why this question looks so different in the consistent histories framework.
I'll try and answer some of this.
Sure.
I'll try and answer some of the second.
One very interesting issue you raised there is there's another question which perhaps I could have put on here, namely worries about the error of time, which on one hand, of course, it's already an extremely deep and profound question without quantum mechanics, right? But takes on some, but there are also specific aspects about it which come up explicitly in quantum mechanics, and for example, touching on the ones that you raised here. And my personal opinion about the question of the error of time is that on one hand, there's been real progress made, on the other hand, we're not done. So the progress, I think, is obvious, so obvious that we forget how shocking it is sometimes. That, you know, we look here in the room and wonder why eggs don't unbreak and things like that, and we've come to realize that the explanation for that has to do with the universe itself, that we started out in some particular way. That to me is a very, 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 very shocking thing, that little eggs have something to do with the Big Bang. But I don't think we're done. I think it's a quite open question how to understand how things started out in cosmology. And I don't know did you want to take a comment on this time, the hour of time, the coherence issue, some?
Not really. I mean, we are slowly beginning to run out of time. I think there's it's clearly important to realize that arrow of time plays a role, right? So, but I think that your take on it, and I think what Jim is probably going to expand on later today is, yes, initial conditions matter.
You take it, sorry. You've been patiently holding hand up for a long time.
Okay, you're quoted in some popular press as saying the one prediction of many worlds is that you will never see a collapse. What would it count to see a collapse?
You want to have an experiment where you see something which looks like decoherence, even though you're able to actually rule out any actual particles or anything else doing the decoherence.
Okay, assuming we're 50 years in the future and we're much better than we are now, how can you tell the difference between decoherence and collapse and GRW or something? How would we actually do that?
So I think there are a number of very exciting experiments which are being devised at the moment. It's taken a long time back from back in the day when you could interfere single electrons and gradually interfere carbon-60 buckyballs and start to do optical fiber Bell inequality violation with a kilometer baseline and sure, things that feel large, and yet there's much bolder stuff going on. For example, Keith Schwab and his lab at Cornell and Aspelmeyer and others in Vienna trying to put these micromechanical cantilevers in two places at once. And now you're upwards to 10 to 15 atoms. Okay. You have also, of course, the huge effort to build quantum computers. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see whether these ultimately work as unitary quantum mechanics would predict, or if they just mysteriously fail.
Yeah, okay, assuming they work, that's good for quantum mechanics. Assuming they all mysteriously fail, will they really conclude that we have seen either collapse or G's and RW or something like that is not unitary?
I think this is ultimately going to come down to how successful experimentalists are in quantifying their systematic errors, you know, which is always the hardest thing for an experimentalist.
But if you show that it's non-unitary, how do you know it's non-unitary collapse as opposed to simple non-unitary?
Because you can estimate the decoherence effect, and this will be an addition to that.
Right, but how do you know whether it's collapse by decoherence extra or non-collapse?
I think the first version of the GIW, if I'm not mistaken, was shown to predict the wrong half-life of the proton.
Yeah, that's right.
That's correct. Yeah. And this was a clear prediction of the theory.
That's right. Yeah.
But you can, if you want to turn down the strength of the effect, since you already have decoherence, you just have it very, very weak so that you don't lie awake at night worrying about being superposed. Because, you know, once in a while. To answer your question, which I think is a good one, in any discovery in physics, you go through two steps. We have a theory which makes clear predictions, namely unitary quantum mechanics, which says if you can get rid of all of the decoherence, these micromechanical cantilevers, Penrose, superposed mirror experiment, and quantum computers should all work in the way the Schrodinger equation predicts. Okay. The first thing one is going to try to do is just test, is that prediction correct or not? If one refutes the null hypothesis of unadulterated unitary quantum, then comes the second question to find out, well, what's going on instead? Which is a harder question. I quite agree, but I would posit that if we get to that stage, people will be so excited that there will be a lot of resources put into really going after that effect.
Max?
Yeah?
You know, I'm worried about your use of the word worry. Why not?
I'm worried about your use of the word worry.
Why not use a word like concern? I think it'd be more meaningful. I'm a word mother.
Okay.
Okay, it's time for one more question. Is that a good question?
Yeah.
Yes, go for it.
Since GIF is mathematical universe hypothesis, everything is equations of heat and math. And the way you say that is, well, look at what you do with it. Everything is equations, so everything should be math, really. That's basically the way you want to be. But I think there's something missing, right? When I write an equation, it's such an equation, there's also a meaning in my head what the symbols are. And I'm trying to understand where would the meaning come from if everything is just equations.
So I would go back to the analogy I made about the car here. You know, if you look at some particular description of the integers, say, right? There are many different mathematicians who use different symbols to denote the successor and the piano symbol and the piano axioms and whatever. So there's a whole equivalence class of different descriptions that are describing the same thing. And it doesn't carry any particular meaning about how you should feel about the number 5 or anything. And if you have a complete description of something, the integers or a car, then anyone who really spends a lot of time examining that described entity will eventually start to develop their own intuition as to this, whenever I press this thing here, the car starts moving faster. And if you work with integers a lot, after a while, you really start
I understand
the car.
I do, right? I
keep the tires and I just. But let me just say something else about the integers then. Suppose I tell you that I'm going to lock you up in the secret basement of the Brenner Institute, okay? And all you get to eat is spam. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to sit there until you've proved 10,000 theorems about piano integers. I'm going to give these 5 axioms of piano and the distributional decision rules. You have to prove 10,000 theorems about this. And suppose also before I do this, I brainwash, I make you forget everything you ever knew about math. So for you, this is just a strange game with some weird rules, okay? What I would put to you is that after a while, after you've cursed a lot about the spam and you've proved your first 50 theorems, you're going to start to systematize things and see certain patterns here. And you're going to, even if there was, there is no symbol for the number one in there or a symbol for number two, you're going to invent that yourself because you're going to find that that's very convenient for proving theorems faster. And you're going to start to invent a variety of other symbols. And then when you come out, finally, when you've proven your 10,000 theorems and you come out, and you start talking to other people, you're going to realize that a lot of the things that you invented there in the basement are things which are already taught in math classes. Does that go anyway to sort of address how intuitions can come out from this formalism?
Yeah, so somehow you're saying they have a rigidity, these things. Yeah. They push back, tell you what they are themselves.
Yeah.
So does that mean that I have to have some sort of time or something? Because I need to sort of go and ask them questions. Do I have to have that before that? Or can it come out too?
Well, the integers don't exist, of course, in some time.
But immediate can exist because I have time, because I spend time with it.
Certainly, to have a self-aware entity like an observer here who can think about integers, we know it. They have to be in some mathematical structure that has some kind of time, so that they can have this one-dimensional progression of thoughts, which correspond to computation.
Right.
Yeah, but that's more a statement about the nature of the observers than the statement about the interviewers, I feel.
I think we should close the rest of the discussion.